Good afternoon, everybody. Shmuel Plotzker coming at you live from my house on behalf of Goffman Synagogue and our School of Jewish Studies. Welcome aboard. It's book club class. We meet every Monday afternoon at 1 o'clock, and we read a book, and right now we're reading The Rav, The World of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, Volume 1. We're in the chapter known as Brisk, and let's get right to it. We've already seen Rabbi Soloveitchik say that Rabbi Chaim Brisker, his grandfather, when he would speak, he's speaking to himself, he would say. And I've got no right to admonish my fellow Jews. I'm going to talk to myself, he'd say. You all can listen in, but whatever I say is really just to me. I'm talking to myself through you. Okay, so let's get on with it. We're on page 231. We're basically almost at the end of this book. It's got some interesting little stories and anecdotes. It's not a very heavy read at all, but it's a chance for us to get to know Rabbi Soloveitchik. I think we're doing that. The Chumash Malamed, here's a little story about a teacher of Chumash, related by Rabbi Soloveitchik to his Talmud class at YU in 1975. There was a Malamed, which means there was a teacher in Brisk, who considered himself an expert in Chumash. He developed a very funny and strange idea. He wanted to teach my grandfather, Reb Chaim, how to really understand Chumash. This is a true story. He recognized that Reb Chaim was a Gaon Olam, a universally recognized genius in Talmud, but the Malamed felt that he knew Chumash better than Reb Chaim. He constantly urged Reb Chaim Brisker to study Chumash with him. Reb Chaim was very tolerant and very careful about the dignity of man. He always tried not to insult or abuse anyone. Reb Chaim was very careful, and therefore the Malamed continued to bother him. When many people were present in Reb Chaim's study, the Malamed would ask Reb Chaim when they would make the time to study Chumash together. Finally, Reb Chaim decided to disprove the Malamed's position. It was Parshas Toldos. And Reb Chaim was in the middle of discussing a passage from the Rambam in Hilchos Kelim, the laws of utensils. This was of little value in the opinion of the Malamed. First, one had to know how to explain a pasuk in the Chumash. This constituted a real achievement. Reb Chaim told the Malamed, "You're right. I don't know Chumash. I studied the commentary of Rashi today and did not understand it. Can you explain it to me?" The Malamed got all excited and exclaimed, "Of course I will explain it to you. What's the difficulty?" Reb Chaim quoted the pasuk, "Jacob simmered a stew, and Esav came in from the field, and he was exhausted. Esav said to Jacob, 'Pour into me now some of that very red stuff, for I am exhausted.'" Genesis 25. Rashi says that the soup was made of red lentils. On that day, Abraham died, that he should not see Esav, his grandson, adopt a wicked lifestyle. Therefore, Yaakov was cooking lentils to provide the first meal for the mourners. Now, why should lentils be the mourners' food? Because they're round like a wheel. Mourning is a wheel that revolves in the world. It touches everyone sooner or later, just as a revolving wheel touches every spot in turn. So says Rashi to Genesis 25. It's still our custom today that mourners eat eggs at their first meal after the burial because they're round and they resemble a wheel. Reb Chaim asked the Malamed how Rashi knew the soup consisted of lentils. Maybe it was pea soup. They're also round. Where did Rashi find out that Jacob was cooking lentils? The Malamed responded that when you utilize the word stew, it generally means lentils. Then the Malamed pointed out that Esav requested some of that very red stuff. Very red stuff must mean red lentils. Reb Chaim told the Malamed, "I have a better proof that Rashi is right. Just go a few sentences further in the Chumash. It says explicitly, Yaakov gave Esav bread and lentil stew." End quote. From then on, the Malamed stopped bothering Reb Chaim about Chumash. He realized that there was very little he could teach Reb Chaim about it. How about that? Here's a great story called An Abandoned Child, related by Rabbi Soloveitchik in his keynote address at the annual convention of the Religious Zionists of America in 1963, translated from the Yiddish. My grandfather, Reb Chaim, along with most other halachic authorities, ruled that it was permissible to desecrate Shabbos in order to save a Jew from apostasy. Reb Chaim's attitude was amply illustrated by a story related to me by Reb Moshe Plotzky. Once the teller, that makes my son smile, right? Plotsky. Reb Moshe Plotzky. He should meet Brodsky. Right. Once the telephone rang, my name is Plotzker, hence the the joy. Rav Moshe Plotsky, well, we don't know. He's living in Brisk. Once the telephone rang in Rav Moshe Plotsky's house on Shabbos, his non-Jewish maid answered the phone and asked who was calling. "This is Chaim of Brisk," came the reply. With shock and trepidation, Rav Moshe Plotsky picked up the phone and said, "Rav Chaim, what has happened? On Shabbos?" Rav Chaim replied, "Take a coach and come to me immediately." Confused, Rav Moshe Plotsky protested, "On Shabbos? People will see me desecrating Shabbos. They'll want to stone me." "Do what I say," commanded Rav Chaim. "An abandoned Jewish child has been left at the church. We must immediately gain his release and bring him to the Jewish orphanage." End of story. Get in a car. We got to go rescue a Jewish child on Shabbos. This man was incredible. There was no talk of, "Well, we have to wait till Abdullah, and then maybe 72 minutes, then we'll go find the kid." No. Chaim Brisker, it wasn't like that. He picks up the phone, he calls Moshe Plotsky, and he says, "Get in the car, we're going." I don't know how many cars there were. I mean, was there a car back there? Take a coach. Get a horse and buggy and get over to me. Remember, Chaim Brisker passed away in 1918. Cars were coming up, I think, at or around that time, but I don't know about Europe. Phones obviously existed. "Do what I say. An abandoned Jewish child has been left at the church. We must immediately gain his release and bring him to the Jewish orphanage." Wow. Page 234. Saving a Jewish youth. Listen to this story. Related by Rabbi Soloveitchik in his lecture at YU's Institute of Mental Health in 1959. When the Governor General of Warsaw, which at that time was part of Russia, was killed by a bomb, a boy from Brisk was involved. He was to be court-martialed and then sentenced to death.
What does that mean?
He was going to be killed, executed by the authorities. Of course, they thought he was involved in the bombing and the killing of this Governor General of Russia. My grandfather of Chaim of Brisk did not wish a Jewish boy to die in such a fashion. I don't know whether Rav Chaim believed in the youth's guilt or not. I don't know what his opinion was, but he wanted to save the boy's life. Rav Chaim received the news of this event on Erev Yom Kippur before he went to shul. He knew that in Russia, bribes worked wonders. Jews cannot survive without this magical policy of bribing officials. In this case, he thought that if he could bribe the ispravnik, Russian word for chief of police, of Brisk to be a character witness for the boy, then the boy would be saved. The chief of police would have to state that the accused was a nice boy who could not have been involved in such an act. The trial was to take place on Yom Kippur morning in Warsaw. At that time, it was about a 7 or 8 hour journey from Brisk. Rav Chaim needed at least 3,000 ruble to cover the bribe and the expenses. This was in 1906, and it was a lot of money at that time. 3,000 ruble, 120 years ago, was money. What did Rav Chaim do? He closed all the shuls in Brisk. You can imagine what this meant in Brisk from 50 years ago. He left only one shul open, the so-called tall shul, or the big shul. Rav Chaim announced that all the Jews of Brisk should come to that shul. Nobody knew for what purpose. Imagine, he had the power, Chaim Brisker had the power to close all the shuls in Brisk and tell all the Jews to come to one shul. There were about 25 or 30 shuls in Brisk, which was then a large Jewish community. All the shuls were closed and the Jews were forced to come to the tall shul for Kol Nidre, Erev Yom Kippur. Chaim went up to the pulpit and he said to them, "Gentlemen, I want you to go home and open up your drawers and bring all the money you have to shul. We won't recite Kol Nidre until we collect the money." The people thought that their rabbi was out of his mind. Do you know what it meant 50 years ago in Brisk to tell people to go home and handle and carry money on Yom Kippur? This is a true story. I'm not adding one word. Rav Chaim and the other members of the Brisk rabbinate remained on the podium. Since Rav Chaim insisted, an order was an order, and it was carried out. In no time, the people brought in the sum of 3,000 ruble. Instead of saying Kol Nidre, Reb Chaim went with a group of prominent laymen of the community to see the chief of police of Brisk. They spoke with him, and somehow the money changed hands. The chief of police asked my grandfather to sign an affidavit on behalf of the boy, to sign on Yom Kippur. My grandfather signed the affidavit right away. The police chief went on the train to Warsaw that very night, said he could appear at the trial in the morning. As the Russian police chief of Brisk, he testified that he was convinced of the boy's innocence. This shows the greatness of my grandfather, his loving kindness, and his feeling of communal responsibility. All you could say is, wow. All you could say is, wow. He broke every rule in the book. He broke every halacha of Yom Kippur. He told people to go deal with money. They dealt with money. He signed the document on Yom Kippur. Then he handed over the money to the guy. What he wasn't doing on Yom Kippur. He traveled to see the guy. We don't know if he needed a coach for that, but probably. I mean, he's not going to maybe walk. Who knows? But whatever he had to do, and he did it in order to save a Jewish life. Because Pikuach Nefesh is everything. Bottom page 235, sinning and apostasy. Related by Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein in his article, Brother Daniel and the Jewish Fraternity in the magazine Judaism. Which, by the way, I think is a conservative journal. There is a point beyond which the apostate cannot go and still remain a Jew. The account can be overdrawn and the rubber band can burst. This principle was underscored and elucidated by Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, one of the greatest rabbis of recent generations, in connection with a specific incident. An eminent apostate was being honored on having reached a milestone, and some leaders of the Russo-Polish Jewish community, whom he had helped on occasion, were anxious to send greetings. Rav Chaim, an inflexible ramrod on matters of principle, refused to participate. Intimates recalled that not long previously he had personally gone to great lengths to help a young Bundist, meaning a communist, known to be an avowed opponent of religion. And so they questioned Reb Chaim about the apparent inconsistency. This one is not behaving like a Jew, and that one's not behaving like a Jew. This one is a Jew as a communist. That one is a Jew as a Catholic. What's the big difference? Who cares? They're both not doing what they're supposed to do. So why are you saying, I'm going to help this one, but I won't help that one? Reb Chaim's reply was immediate and to the point. That one was a sinner. This one is a meshumet, an apostate. The communist, he's a sinner. Many people are sinners. But the other guy, he's a meshumet. That's the Hebrew term for apostate. He left the religion. His children already won't even know that they're Jewish. Now, the question you could ask is, don't you think that a person remains a Jew even though he converts? Because it doesn't matter what he says. I mean, if he's got bris milah, born of a Jewish mother, so what if he's thinking wrong thoughts and he adopts the wrong thoughts? So what? He was a member of the Jewish people, and he still is. It happens to be that he's off the path, but he should get back on the path quick. But Reb Chaim Soloveitchik didn't seem to take that approach. He felt that there's a point beyond which the apostate cannot go and still remain a Jew, that the account can be overdrawn and the rubber band can be bursting. He felt that once you do certain things, that's it. You're out of the Jewish fold. Amazingly, I wouldn't have thought that. I, along with the other people, would have questioned him about the apparent inconsistency. But he drew the line between somebody who converted to another religion and somebody who just merely became a communist. Reb Chaim's anteroom, his antechamber, his like a room within a room. Rabbi Eliezer Silver, love to describe to me, speaking about himself, Rabbi Yosef Soloveitchik, Rabbi Eliezer Silver, love to describe to me what my grandfather's home was like in Brisk. The acts of chesed of Reb Chaim came to the fore in his residence. Notices were placed by strangers all over the walls of his anteroom. Can you imagine having a living room and there are pashkevilim everywhere? Imagine notices. So-and-so died. There's a job for somebody if he wants. Go eat food over here at this open kitchen. So-and-so will let you into this flop house. Signs everywhere in Reb Chaim's house. Poor people would take naps on the couch in that room. Reb Chaim would never awaken or disturb these unfortunate individuals. Can you believe it? I believe it. Because that's not the only place I've heard that story. People were, it was a flop house. He had, can you imagine if we had like 30 or 40 poor people in this house, sleeping them in old rooms? It'd be even messier than it is. And that I can't even imagine. How could it be? How could it be messier than it is? Well, try to inject 30 people and their stuff into your house, and you'll see a messy house. Mendel, it would be messier here in this house than it is right now, if that's even humanly possible. What do you say, Mendel? Not even a laugh, just a small, weak smile. Wow, now he's laughing. Watch how great Reb Chaim Brisker was, the burial society story, related by Rabbi Soloveitchik in his essay, Halachic Man. The great Torah giants, the Halachic men par excellence, were indeed champions of truth and justice. They glowed with a resplendent ethical beauty. Space does not permit me even to begin to speak, for example, about Reb Chaim's unrelenting efforts to realize the ideals of righteousness and equity. Let me merely cite one incident wherewith to conclude this section. Once, two Jews died in Brisk on the same day. In the morning, a poor shoemaker who had lived out his life in obscurity died, while about noontime, a wealthy, prominent member of the community passed away. According to the halacha, in such a case, the one who dies first must be buried first. That's Yoredeah 354. However, the members of the burial society, the Chevra Kadisha, who had received a handsome sum from the heirs of the rich man, they decided to attend to him first, despite the fact that he had died later. For who was there to plead the cause of the poor man? Oh boy, I think you know where this is going. When Reb Chaim was informed about the incident, he sent a messenger of the court to warn the members of the Chevra Kadisha to desist from their disgraceful behavior. Stop it. Stop what you're doing. You have no right to bury the wealthy man first. He passed away later. So he gets treated and buried later. First come, first served. The members of the Chevra Kadisha, however, refused to heed the directive of Reb Chaim, and they began to make the arrangements for the burial of the rich man. They ignored Reb Chaim Brisker. Uh-oh. I think you see where this is going. This can't end well. Mm-hmm. Reb Chaim then arose. He took his walking stick. He trudged over to the house of the deceased, and he chased all the attendants outside. Reb Chaim prevailed. The poor man was buried before the rich one. Reb Chaim's enemies multiplied and increased. Thus have true halachic men always acted, because their study and their deeds have blended together beautifully. Truly beautifully. How about that? And his enemies multiplied and increased. And did he care? Not one bit. How can you care? How can anybody care about having enemies? Friends, enemies. One minute a friend, the next minute an enemy, then back again. How can you care? If you're a man of halacha, you got to do what it says. So do what it says. You can't do it, don't be a rabbi. Don't call yourself rabbi if you can't do basic Jewish law. Rav Chaim says, I'm going to kick them all out. And he did. Can you imagine Rav Chaim Brisker doing that, taking up his walking stick and either threatening to hit people or actually hitting people? Get out of here. Get out. And he did it. He chased them all out. Amazing man. Amazing man. Worth reading about him. Page 238, a new chapter. Rabbi Eliyahu Feinstein. Differences between the grandfathers. Related by Rabbi Soloveitchik in his annual Yahrzeit Shir in memory of his father, Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik, delivered in 1952 at YU, published in Hebrew. I refer to my two grandfathers, my grandfather on my mother's side, Rabbi Eliyahu Feinstein of Prizhana, and my grandfather on my father's side, Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik of Brisk. Can you even imagine what that chasana looked like? The two, the machatunim, Rabbi Chaim Brisker and Rabbi Eliyahu Feinstein Prizhana. My goodness.
What does that mean, Prizhana?
That's where he's from, Prizhan, in White Russia, of Prizhana. They called him Rabbi Eliyahu Prizhana.
I want to know what does that mean? What?
We're not getting into that. Both were great Torah scholars and saintly personalities, but they were very different. They differed from each other in a unique way. Rabbi Eliyahu Prizhana entered the rabbinate at the age of 16. He remained a spiritual leader until his death at the age of 86, devoting 70 years to the rabbinate. 70 years he was a rabbi. His character exemplified piety and abstinence. He was always dressed in rabbinic clothing. No one ever saw him in short clothing, that is modern clothing. Whether it was hot or cold, he always wore the long frock that characterized the traditional rabbi. He never walked quickly. His pace was always dignified. No one ever saw him roar in laughter. And he never spoke at length or had frivolous conversations with people on the street. His words were few, and his every action was weighed. My grandfather would rise, that meaning Rabbi Eliyahu Prizhan, he would rise with the sun every day in order to learn and pray the morning prayers at the earliest hour. Never did he show excitement, and never did he show emotion. You could not tell whether he was sad or whether he was happy. My grandfather was never too close or too distant from anyone. In a word, he was the total representative of the golden path. His deportment totally radiated dignity. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik of Brisk, my other grandfather, was exactly the opposite. Even though he was the greatest intellect of his generation, he was filled with emotion and sensitivity. At times he would be happy and overjoyed, and at times he would be sad and haunted with melancholy thoughts. Sometimes he would bitterly fight with the strength of a cedar tree, and other times he would be as soft as a reed. Rav Chaim was a person of conflicting emotions and inner contradictions. Throughout his life, he never maintained a set schedule. He never ate at the same time. He never prayed at the same time. Every day he had to take care to make sure that he recited the Shema at the proper time. Rav Chaim never dressed like a rabbi. When he traveled by train, no one recognized him as Rav Chaim of Brisk. When he recited the Shemoneh Esrei, he would be one of the first to finish, and he would wait for its repetition by the reader. He would always greet people first, and he would be the first to bless his fellow Jews with Sabbath greetings. Many times you could find Rav Chaim surrounded by a group of young children at play. He acted as the horse for them on the floor. The children would grab and pull his frock and cry out to him, "Giddy up! Forward!" At all times, anyone could freely approach him because he was very democratic. One cannot say that he was a well-organized person because he did not function in a harmonious, calculated, disciplined, and coordinated fashion. He developed his unique and genius intellect by himself with almost no help from rabbis or teachers. Through his own abilities, he was responsible for a revolution in halachic methodology. His warm and open heart was developed because of his intense desire to possess such traits. My late father told me that Rav Chaim once said to him, "Moshe, Do not think that I am inherently good. My character is actually bad. One must force oneself to develop gracious character traits. A person must transform himself. I have worked hard to uproot any trace of cruelty from myself. Chaim Brisker, about whom they lauded and praised him for his kindness, on his tombstone it says, "Here lies Chaim of Brisk, Rav Chesed." Rav Chesed is how we address Hashem. Rav Chesed ve'emes, great in kindness and in truth. That's what they refer to Rav Chaim. That same Russian that we would talk about to God, that's what they call Rav Chaim Brisker, Rav Chesed. So what are our actions going to equal his? Page 240, Grandfathers in Debate, related by Rabbi Soloveitchik in a Talmudic lecture in Boston in 1974. My mother's father, Elia Prajana, was an Ish Chassid, truly a pious man. He knew all the Talmud by heart, plain and simple, by heart. This is not a Hasidish Meiser. He could repeat all the Talmudic texts by heart. He was totally conversant with all the volumes of Horah, which are codes of practical halacha. He knew it all. Still, he would tell me when I was a young boy that he belonged to the generation before the giving of the Torah. That's a reference to the new method of analysis introduced by Rabbi Soloveitchik's other grandfather, Chaim Brisker. He belonged to the generation before the giving of the Torah. What was the giving of the Torah then? Moshe at Sinai? No! Rav Chaim Brisker's revolution in Talmudical thought, giving to the world the Brisker Derech of learning. Tzvei Derachim, Tzvei Halachas, distinguishing Halacha from Halacha, seeing the Rambam, not just seeing his code of Jewish law, the Mishnah Torah, as a code of Halacha, but viewing that Sefer as the Rambam's commentary on the Talmud. Very revolutionary approach. And so that as soon as you read the Talmud, you go straight to the Rambam to see how he understood the Talmud. Most don't do that. Most see Rashi, Tosfos. But if you're a Brisker, you just go straight to the Rambam. What did the Rambam say? What's the halacha? What's his pirish al ha-Talmud? What's his explanation of the Talmud? Amazing. Rabbi Eliyahu Prajana once told me a story about Rav Chaim Brisker. The latter, Rav Chaim Brisker, was very stringent in keeping the mitzvah, the obligation of hearing and reading the Torah on Mondays and Thursdays. He would leave the train and look for a minyan in small towns. Rav Chaim held that the chiyuv, the obligation to hear the reading of the Torah, was a personal and individual obligation. That is to say, it was a chovas hayachid, that the individual Jew was obligated to hear the reading of the Torah, although it can only be fulfilled with a minyan. He held that the obligation stems from the precept of Torah study. This obligation devolves on the individual. It's just like you have an obligation to learn Torah every day. If the Torah's got to be read, that's the Torah. That's Torah study. So you have an obligation to hear it. This obligation, he felt, devolves on the individual. And there is no special fulfillment of learning Torah with a minyan. You have an obligation to learn Torah even without a minyan. However, Moshe and Ezra introduced the concept that the fulfillment of the individual obligation of listening to the reading of the Torah was to be done in a communal setting. Nevertheless, the obligation is an individual one, felt of Chaim Brisker. So my grandfather, Rav Elia Prajana, told me, "Knew I showed Rav Chaim a clear source in the Ramban, which declares that the obligation of reading the Torah is a communal duty. However, you know your Zaidi. When his way of thinking was crystallized, you cannot budge him. Even the specific," that's an amazing thing, though. Just to say that is an amazing thing to say, because it's not true. Because it's just not true. Rav Chaim Brisker, we have a story right here in this book. Rav Chaim Brisker gave over a shiur because people were talking about his new method and see in Talmud study. And the great ones of the day wanted to hear him. So there was Chanan Spector, the great Gaon, for whom YU is named, the yeshiva's name, and others. They came to hear him. They thought it was great. But Rav Chaim found a mistake in his own thinking. So he said, "I made a mistake. Ignore everything I said. I'm so sorry." And he stepped down. They made him the Rosh Hashiva of a Lajan, because anybody that genius and also that humble deserves to be the Rosh Hashiva. Are you with me? It didn't hurt. It did not hurt Chaim Brisker that he acknowledged in his own head, oh my, there's another source out there that's going up against me, and I just thought of it, and therefore it's knocking me out. Oh boy, I guess it knocks me out. I'm really sorry. I just spent an hour developing a thought. I think the thought's wrong now that I think about it. Everybody had a very good day, and he sat down. So they were shell-shocked. What do you mean you're wrong? As far as we're concerned, you're wrong day and night. You're the genius. You're incredible. I mean, what do you mean you're wrong? You can do no wrong in our eyes. You're the Rosh Hashiva of Elohim. And your humility is incredible. So Reb Chaim was able to acknowledge if he made a mistake, he made a mistake. So what's Pshat Rabbi Eliyahu Prigianer saying once his thinking was crystallized, you could not budge him.
Maybe he meant that anyone else can budge him, but he himself
couldn't. Ah, Mendel's thinking like a good Talmudist. Mm-hmm. Mendel's a student of the Talmud, and he's differentiating, he's distinguishing between somebody else trying to influence him and Reb Chaim Brisker himself influencing Reb Chaim Brisker himself. Well, I'm going to have to reject that.
Why?
Because Reb Chaim, I don't think that's true. I don't think Reb Chaim Brisker, in his incredible humility and honesty, in his intellectual honesty, that he would care who the messenger is. Either it's his own brain saying, wait, there's a Rambam, oh my gosh, I just remembered. Or somebody else saying, wait, there's a Rambam. Or there's a Ramban.
Oh, there's a Rambam.
Right. No. Let's hear what he says. But it's an amazing thing to say. I mean, once his thinking is crystallized, you could not budge him. Even the specific words of a Rishon will not make him alter his opinion. Amazing. Chaim simply reinterpreted the Ramban to fit in with his thinking. Actually, Rabbi Elia Prigianer was correct. At the time of this conversation, I don't know, or I did not know which passage in the Ramban he was referring to. I was a young boy at the time, and I did not dare to ask him the source. Later, I found it on my own. The Ramban says it in his commentary to Masechta Megillah. That's the Ramban's Mochemet Hashem to the riff on Megillah 3a. He openly declares that the reading of the Torah is a duty incumbent on the community, not on the individual. So says the Ramban himself, Nachmanides. I don't know how my grandfather, Reb Chaim, could have reinterpreted the Ramban. Of course, the Ramban is right. There is no doubt about it. However, Rebellion told me, you know your Zaidi with his ironclad words. What he did not like, he did not like. Once his mind was made up, you could not budge him. All right, let's continue. Of course, Reb Elia was in Volozhin too, but he was in Volozhin before Reb Chaim Brisker came. Reb Elia was actually a Talmud Mubak of Reb Eliezer Yitzchak Fried, the son-in-law and the successor of Reb Yitzchak of Volozhin, and also a Talmud Mubak of the Netziv. Reb Elia had the same approach to learning that his teachers had. You can discern this from Reb Elia's published writings, Halichot Elio, published in Vilna in 1932. So not everybody was keen on adopting Reb Chaim Brisker's approach to learning Torah. I dabbled in it years ago when I was in Baltimore. I asked a Kola guy, or a very learned yeshiva guy, to sit and study some Reb Chaim Brisker with me. So we got our hands on Reb Chaim. I have it still downstairs. Reb Chaim Halevi, Ala Shas, the Chedushi Reb Chaim Halevi. And we went through one or two pieces, and I was enjoying it. Now, I'm reading an article by Rabbi Dr. Mark Shapiro, and in that article in Chakira, the most recent Chakira, the question becomes, you know, what if the Rambam himself doesn't really say what Reb Chaim is saying he said? In other words, Reb Chaim comes up with a whole lumdus. No, but they asked the Rambam, what is your thinking on that? And he said, oh, my thinking is I may have made a mistake, or it's X, Y, Z. And Reb Chaim has got a whole structure called A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K. And the Rambam says, no, it's X, Y, Z. Does it really matter? Does it really matter to anybody if the Rambam does not come to the rescue of Reb Chaim Brisker? Does it matter if Reb Chaim Brisker has his own Chiddushim, which don't agree with what the Rambam himself wrote about what he himself wrote in Mishneh Torah? And the answer is probably not. Probably doesn't matter at all. Because Reb Chaim has his genius, he's got his insights, and if this works out, if it all worked out in some sort of structure that he managed to create, and it's all Oiska Halkin, so then in his genius, he found something that the Rambam himself didn't seem to be having in mind. Go figure that one out. Amazing world. So this has to be kind of, and I just wrote a little note over here, but he publicly changed his mind in a shiur before Gedolim. Ray, the Belarjiner Shashiva ship. You got to go find that story. Okay, we continue. Bottom page 241. Upright man, related by the Rav in his Tshuva Drasha in 1973. This drasha is dedicated to the blessed memory of Rabbi Yosef Elio Henkin. On the Lower East Side, he was simply known as Rav Henkin. Passed away when I was 10 years old. Never got a chance to meet this man. I was 10. Now, he didn't pass when he was 10. He passed when I was 10 years old. And therefore, nobody ever took me to see him. I don't think that he came into the yeshiva. I don't know where he davened. If he was davening Bialystok Shul, that maybe I wasn't davening in Bialystok Shul before the age of 10. And maybe he did daven in Bialystok, I just never saw him. Maybe he davened in some other shtiebel. I don't know too much about this man. Other than I knew he lived in the FDR Drive, I think, and he lived on the Lower East Side, and people came to him with shilas. He was extremely, extremely learned. He was almost on par with Moshe Feinstein, which is an astonishing thing to say. I mean, literally, he was great. He was an incredible Torah scholar. Writes Rabbi Soloveitchik, I'm not certain why, but whenever I met Rabbi Henkin, he always reminded me of my grandfathers, Reb Chaim Brisker and Reb Elia Prejana. Reb Henkin especially reminded me of my mother's father, Reb Elia Prejana. What was the common denominator between them? Besides their aura of genius and rabbinic knowledge and their piety, they shared a similar lifestyle. It was characterized by simplicity and total straightforwardness. They were totally honest and free from crookedness or deceit. Pasuk in Ecclesiastes proves it. Ecclesiastes chapter 7. God made man upright. Excuse me. It is man who seeks out intrigues and develops other considerations. Pasuk says, but they sought other intrigues. These many intrigues, but they sought many intrigues, is the Pasuk. God has made man upright, but they sought out many intrigues. These many intrigues and extraneous considerations were totally lacking in the personalities of Elio Henkin and my grandfather of Elio Prejana. They lived simple and truthful lives. They did not seek to impress others and even understated their own best erudition. They were open-hearted and honest. They never issued orders and never insisted that others do only what they understood to be correct. However, people did follow Rav Henkin and Rav Elio Prejana because it seemed the natural course of action. Their simplicity and honesty made a deep impression upon others. Their personalities reminded me, if I may use a metaphor, of the first man, Adam, before he sinned. Rav Henkin and Rav Elio Prejana never carried on a dialogue with the serpent. They never involved themselves in philosophy. Such Jews are very rare. I fear that Rav Henkin was the last of them, the last of the Jews who inscribed as their motto, God has made man upright. This is after he passed away. This is right after he passed away. A little footnote over here about Rav Henkin, and there's stuff about him also on the web. Rav Henkin, born 1880, was the director of Ezra's Torah. an organization founded in 1915 by the OU, by the Union of Orthodox Rabbis. Might not be the OU per se, but it might have been the Union of Orthodox Rabbis, different organization, to provide assistance to rabbinical scholars in war-torn Europe. Rav Henkin was widely recognized as a halachic authority on contemporary problems. His published writings were later collected and issued in two volumes by Ezra's Torah under the title Kitfei Hagon Rav Yosef Eliyahu Henkin, Volume 2, published in 1980, Volume 1, 1980, Volume 2, in 1989. Wow. You know what? I think he passed away on the 14th day. Oh, yeah. His patir was on 13 Ba'av. Yud Gimel Ba'av. Maybe we should do a special remembrance service for him. It's a thought. It's a thought. Just a thought. Continuing, page 243. Grandmother Gutta's engagement. Listen to this, Mendel. Are you awake, O Mendel? Mendel, are you there? We're going to go to the end of this chapter. Grandmother Gutta's engagement, related by Rabbi Soloveitchik in his lecture on the institution of marriage in 1972. The author writes, at the end of this lecture, the Rav was asked, when is it really love? What guidelines can one use in order to determine if the person one is physically attracted to is really the right person? Are there any guidelines in the tradition that can indicate when someone would be the right mate for someone else? The Rav responded, you need advice. I must tell you that many times I am very critical of your choices. There was laughter. I don't know, Rabbi Soloveitchik says, I don't know. It's hard. This is a subjective matter. You know very well that my grandmother told me, or I heard my grandmother tell, the following story. When she was 12 years old, she was playing in the yard with her friends. Suddenly, her mother came out of the house and said, Gutta, come in. She went in. Mazel tov, you're engaged. Now, she was 12, and my grandfather, Avelia Prajana, was 15. I can tell you that there was no more ideal marital community than the community that they founded. This I can tell you. I still remember as a child how I observed their devotion and love for each other. I also remember the harmony in their relationship. However, my grandmother had no criteria by which to choose. She had no criteria to guide her in her choice because she simply did not choose. It was given to her. Little footnote. Gutta Chisa Davidovich married Rabbi Yoel Feinstein in 1850. She was descended from Rabbi Yomtov Lippman Heller, the author of the Tosfos Yomtov on the Mishnah, and Rabbi Chil Halperin, the author of the Seder Hadoros. Amazing. She was 12, he was 15. Mazel tov, you're engaged. Top page 244. The wedding fast, related by Rabbi Herschel Schachter in Nefesh HaRav. On the day of the marriage of the Rav's parents, Pesia Feinstein and Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, Rav Chaim sent a messenger, oh my goodness, a man by the name of Rabbi Yisrael Kamelnitsky, the personal attendant of Rav Chaim. His name was Rabbi Yisrael Kmelnitsky. My goodness, what a name. Well, in any event, on the day of the marriage of Rabbi Soloveitchik's parents, Pesia Feinstein and Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik, Chaim Brisker, the father of the cousin, sent a messenger to his future daughter-in-law, Pesia Feinstein, informing her that she need not fast on the day of her wedding. Chaim Brisker felt that everyone was considered sick in relation to the obligation to fast on minor fasts, and therefore she was exempt from the custom of fasting on the day of her wedding. No need to fast on your wedding. It's like a minor fast. And everybody is a chayla, and therefore, since everybody's a chayla, there's no need to fast on minor fasts or on your wedding day. The bride, however, told the messenger to inform of Chaim that Prajana, the city where she lived, had its own rabbinic scholars. There was no need for the rulings of rabbis from outside the city. She said that she would fast in accordance with the decision of her father, Rabbi Leo Feinstein, the rabbi of Prajana. And the rabbi of Prajana, who happened to be your father, was of the halachic opinion that on the day of your wedding, you fast. And so she thanked Rav Chaim, thank you so much, but we have local rabbis over here, and we follow them, and one of them is my own father. And if he says I fast on my wedding day, guess what? I'm fasting on my wedding day. And so she did. Feeding the cats. donated by Rabbi Soloveitchik and a Shir Congregation Moria. That's in Manhattan, 1971. The halacha is in accordance with the statement of our sages that Gemara Brachas, the man is forbidden to eat before he gives food to his beast. Brachas 40a. This idea is derived from the pasuk in the Torah, which states, I shall provide grass in your field for your cattle. And only afterwards does the Torah declare, and you will eat and you will be satisfied. So first you feed the animals. That's the order that you see in the Torah. First feed the animals, then you feed yourself. My grandfather, Rebellia Prajana, would always insist on feeding the cats before he ate. It was not so simple, for you had to find out where the cats were in the house. After all, the cats did not know that my grandfather was about to eat. That got laughter. Nevertheless, he would not sit down to eat until food was placed before the cats. The alarm would go on throughout the Feinstein household to search for the cats. This is not an allegory, but it's an exact account of what took place in my grandfather's home. First you feed the cats, then you feed yourself. Finally, an incredible story. We'll leave, end with this. Death and the halacha. Mendel, are you awake? Half hour to your program at the school. Death and the halacha. Related by the Rav in his essay, Halachic Man. It is related concerning the Gaon of Vilna, how greatly he would rejoice on Simchas Torah during the Hakafas. He would dance, clap, sing, and celebrate the occasion in a state of great rapture and enthusiasm. However, immediately afterward, upon the conclusion of the Hakafas, he would revert back to his normal, tranquil state. When the Vilna Gaon's brother died, and the Gaon heard of it on the Shabbos, when mourning is forbidden, he did not display any emotion or signs of grief. After Shabbos, when he concluded the Havdalah, he burst into tears. The beloved daughter of Elio Prajana Feinstein took sick about a month before she was to be married, and after a few days, she was rapidly sinking. Rav Elia's son entered the room where Rav Elia, wrapped in talis and tefillin, was praying with the congregation to tell him that his daughter was in her death throes. Rav Elia Prajana went into his daughter's room and asked the doctor how much longer it would be until the end. When he received the doctor's reply, Rav Elia Prajana returned to his room, removed his Rashi tefillin, quickly put on the tefillin prescribed by Rabbeinu Tam. He acted quickly because immediately upon his daughter's death, he would be an onen, a mourner whose dead relative has not as yet been buried. And therefore, as such, he would be subject to the law that an onen is exempt from all the commandments. Therefore, he would not be putting on any tefillin when he becomes an onen. I mean, once he puts on, he has got Rashi on right now. Okay, so he fulfilled Rashi. But if it turns out that his daughter passes away this very second, then he instantly becomes an onen. He becomes a person who is not obligated to do anything but deal with the mitzvah of kvura sameis, of burying the dead.
Why didn't he try to
save her? So there's nothing to save. She was on her way out. So he therefore knew that, and therefore he went to the doctor and said, how much longer? Doctor might have said an hour. So then he quickly took off his Rashi tefillin and put on his Rabbeinu Tam tefillin so he could fulfill the Rabbeinu Tam, because once the daughter passes away, if he has not yet put on Rabbeinu Tam, he won't be able to. And he doesn't want to take a chance of missing out on Rabbeinu Tam tefillin.
But if he doesn't have to, could he still?
I'm not asking halacha questions you have to have. You got to ask other people.
Mm-hmm.
So the answer is no. You just metapa with the mitzvah of Kavusa Mace. And you don't do anything but that. That's the halacha. What is interesting is that he's a real litvak, a Talmud of Velazhin, and he's putting on Rabbeinu Tam tefillin. I got to explore that. It's not a Lubavitcher thing only. Okay. After he removed his second pair of tefillin, he wrapped them up and put them away. He then entered his dying daughter's room in order to be present at the moment his most beloved daughter would return her soul back to its maker. We have here great strength and presence of mind, the acceptance of the divine decree with love, the consciousness of the law and the judgment, the might and the power of the halacha, and we see faith strong as flint. Unbelievable. Unbelievable story. The presence of mind, the lack of emotion, just doing what the halacha requires, following it step by step, word for word, doing it. Really amazing. And with that, we'll end the class. Thank you everybody so much for joining me. With Hashem, next week, we should also be able to do our class on the 16th of May. And we'll do a chapter called Prijana and Razain, the concept of tradition. We're slowly but surely getting to the end. Only another 30 pages or so. Wishing everybody a good day. Zeitz Gesund and Kol Tov. Thank you, Jake and Mitch, for making it happen at sheer enjoyment. Thank you, Government of Synagogue and our School of Jewish Studies. Take care and be well, everybody. Have a good day. See you tomorrow night for Tanakh Tuesday at 7:30. All the best. Bye for now.